Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need the shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, or it's easier to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. From the DW Business Desk, Kate Ferguson presents the topic of increased spending on nuclear weapons. Last year, the world spent $91 billion on nuclear arsenals, a 13% increase from 2022. The U.S. led the race with $51 billion, China second at $12 billion, and Russia third with $8 billion. In the United States, lobbyists spent over $17 million promoting nuclear weapons to politicians. When the U.S. extended its nuclear umbrella to South Korea, the North had no arsenal, but now may have up to 50 warheads. NATO has 4,200 warheads, most of them American, and this year's U.S. presidential election could change its stability. And speaking of the U.S. election, the role of money in this year's campaigns is huge. $4 billion was spent in 2020, and that will be surpassed this year. After some statistics are presented, Professor Ray LaRaha from the University of Massachusetts discusses how the money is further polarizing the nation. He compares the European model of public campaign financing to the American system. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Sometimes it's numbers and not words that tell the most compelling story. Last year, global spending on nuclear weapons rose 13% to more than $91 billion. All 9 of the world's nuclear powers upped their investment, together pumping almost $3,000 into atomic weapons every second. This is strange. For decades, the number of nuclear weapons has been falling, a result of Cold War tensions easing. Now it looks like the nuclear arms race is heating up again. Russia and the US are still by far the biggest owners of nuclear weapons, with more than 5,000 warheads each. But other powers are building up their stockpiles too. When it comes to spending, the US still leads the way, investing over $50 billion last year. China comes in second, and Russia is third. If you take a step back, these are crazy numbers, especially because nuclear weapons are never supposed to be used. That doesn't mean they aren't massive business, though. In some countries, the US, UK, France, and India, the nuclear weapons industry relies heavily on private companies, whereas in China, Russia, North Korea, Pakistan, and Israel, government agencies are mainly responsible. From a purely corporate perspective, there's no shortage of opportunity. Nuclear weapons need to be produced, maintained, and stored, and no one company does all of those things. Many defense companies are also publicly traded, meaning shareholders have a vested interest in the nuclear arms race heating up. And according to a report by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, companies spend millions lobbying governments to invest in nuclear weapons every year. Okay, so that's what's been happening. The big question is why? The first thing to know is that defense budgets in general have risen because of the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. The conflict in Sudan has received less media coverage, but it's added to the feeling that the world is becoming increasingly insecure. Summing up this sentiment, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently concluded that the world is becoming less safe by the day. But there's something else happening here too, something that might be even more relevant. And it's to do with the balance of power on the world stage. Once upon a time, the nuclear arms race was pretty much a battle between the United States and the Soviet Union, reflecting a classic clash of Cold War ideologies. In that bipolar world, the US guaranteed the security of its non-nuclear armed allies, a principle known as the nuclear umbrella. As a result, countries like South Korea and Japan, as well as the entire NATO alliance, came to depend on America's nuclear arsenal. But that security guarantee is weakening for a number of reasons. Let's go through three of them. First of all, China has got a whole lot more powerful. It still doesn't have nearly as many nuclear weapons as the US or Russia, but the pace of development is fast. China's expected to have 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2035, three times what it has now. According to a report by the Federation of American Scientists, China is now capable of launching nuclear warheads from land, sea, and air. It's also continued to expand development of its nuclear-capable DF-26 intermediate-range ballistic missile and update its ballistic missile submarines with longer-range weapons. When the United States first offered South Korea protection under its nuclear umbrella, North Korea didn't have nuclear weapons. A few decades later, it's a very different picture. Accurate information about the country's nuclear capabilities is hard to come by, but it's thought to possess up to 1,500 kilograms of highly enriched uranium and 80 kilograms of plutonium. For context, a single atomic bomb requires about 25 kilos of uranium and 8 kilos of plutonium. Surveys now show that a majority of South Koreans believe their country should develop its own nuclear weapons. Basically, there's a growing sense right now that old assurances can no longer be relied on. And that brings us to our third point, the stability or lack thereof of the world's biggest military alliance, NATO. Much of what happens in this area depends on the outcome of the US election in November. Donald Trump has long been critical of what he sees as America's outsized role in global defense. The prospect of a second Trump presidency has prompted a lot of soul searching among Europeans. Does America's nuclear umbrella still offer protection? And if it doesn't, what does that mean for nuclear armed countries like France and the UK? There are no clear answers yet. But in a sign of how times are changing, Poland recently declared its willingness to host nuclear weapons on its territory. A sign perhaps that European countries are ready to play a bigger role in nuclear deterrence. Meanwhile, in another part of the world, India and Pakistan have been busy building up their nuclear weapons in an attempt to ward each other off further conflict. A reminder of how many more fronts there now are in the realm of nuclear deterrence. We've mentioned a lot of numbers in this video, but there's one we need to make sure we never forget. 246,000. That's the number of people estimated to have died in the atomic bomb attacks on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Today's weapons could have even more devastating consequences. Whether all this investment in nuclear weapons is making the world a safer place? Well, I'll let you decide.
To the US now, where Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign says it has now raised more than $500 million for the election battle against Republican nominee and former President Donald Trump. The Harris campaign said that almost a third of the donations came from first-time contributors. The Trump campaign, meanwhile, reported having more than $300 million on hand at the start of the month. The figures underscore the huge role money plays in modern U.S. election campaigns.
Running for president has always been expensive, but campaign budgets have exploded in recent years, from a few $100 million in 1980 to nearly $4 billion in 2020. Where does it all come from? Individuals and corporations. And the money flows to campaigns and political action committees, or PACs. Individuals can only give a few $1,000s to a candidate's campaign, but can get around this by donating to PACs, which then give money to the campaigns. Corporations can only contribute to PACs. To escape all the limits, there's a different category of so-called super PACs that can spend money to influence the election, usually on advertising, but are not allowed to coordinate with the candidate's campaign. A lot of money going a lot of places, but does it matter? Let's take a look back at that spending chart. If we break it down by how much each party spent in each election, we see Democrats started spending much more than Republicans, starting about 10 years ago, ahead of the 2016 election. That year, Hillary Clinton outspent Donald Trump by almost 2-1. Yet, she lost. The loser also spent more in 1984, 1996, and 2004. So, why isn't money the definitive answer to winning an election? There are many factors, the decreasing reach of expensive TV ads and rising partisanship among them. Why do wealthy people give so much? Some are gambling that they're backing the winner and want to have influence after the candidate takes office. Some give to both sides, so they're on record for donating to the winner either way. And some just believe in their chosen candidate, whether they need the money or not.
And to talk more about money in U.S. politics, I'm now joined by political science professor Raila Raja from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he's also co-director of the UMass Amherst poll. Professor, campaign finance, one of your areas of expertise, does spending the most money guarantee a win?
It helps a lot, but there are other factors that go into this. And especially in a presidential election, just think about it. So much money is spent, and that last dollar doesn't make a huge difference. Plus the fact that so much media attention is focused on these candidates that at the end of the day, the campaign ads, it's hard to tell if this money makes a difference.
Now, in our report, we heard that the reach of money is being affected by rising partisanship. You have written a book, Campaign Finance and Political Polarization, for international viewers. Please explain what that relationship is.
So the issue here, you're at a very good clip that shows why people give money. But the other reason people give money is they're passionate. They're ideological. And much more than the rest of the American electorate. So what's happening is ideological people are trying to recruit candidates and give them money to win. That makes the candidates go apart. Okay, so money is having a polarizing effect. It's not just money to make deals. A lot of that big money is coming from people who have strong feelings about issues. And our society in America is divided on these issues. And money is aiding that by who they're giving to.
Now, you're also the co-director of the UMass poll. How big an issue is campaign finance for voters? Is it something they want to see changed?
They hate it. The United States is the Wild West. Money flows in and out. They think it's corrupt. And, you know, they have a point that, think about 50 rich people have given $1.5 billion in a race now. As your video showed, it's going to these super PACs outside. They hate it. The problem is, unlike in Germany, they don't like public financing. They think that's welfare for politicians. So we're kind of caught in between. They hate all this money, but they don't want to pay for public financing of parties or candidates.
Now, that's one side. That's what the electorate wants. You're an expert in party financing. Can it be changed, the system?
It's very hard. Why? Because the parties are so far apart on this issue. Democrats want it one way, Republicans want it the other way. And the American electorate is divided. I personally think more money should flow through the political parties because they're more accountable. It's a lot of money, but at least I know who's spending it and what they stand for. Right now, we have billionaires running groups called Americans for a Better America. Who are they? So there's too much of this, like I said, Wild West, because a lot of the money the parties aren't allowed to raise themselves and spend. So I would say let's do it more like what they do in Germany and Europe and spend more money through the political parties.
Professor Raila Raja there. Thank you very much.
That report and interview were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, NHK Japan. Japan reported a Chinese military aircraft drifted into Japanese territory for the first time. The United States and Indonesia began military drills with 20 other nations participating or observing. Ukrainian President Zelensky says he has a peace plan with Russia to be presented to Biden next month. The next day, Zelensky announced that his pilots were now flying U.S.-gifted F-16s in the war and that he wants more. Ukrainian drones started a fire at a Russian fuel depot. NHK Japan.
The defense ministry says a Chinese military aircraft has intruded into Japan's airspace for the first time. Officials say a Y-9 intelligence gathering plane came from the direction of continental China. They say it flew toward the Japanese island of Kyushu. The red line shows the flight route. The plane circled southeast of the Danjo Islands. It then entered Japanese airspace from the east and stayed for about 2 minutes. That was in spite of warnings from a Japanese fighter. The defense ministry says it cannot say whether the Chinese plane responded. It also says the fighter did not use any weapons. Officials are keeping up surveillance while analyzing the Chinese flight's purpose. They describe the airspace violation as extremely regrettable. The Japanese Foreign Ministry summoned a senior official from the Chinese embassy. It lodged a strong protest and urged China to prevent a recurrence. The embassy official said he'd report back to his government. Indonesia and the United States have kicked off their annual joint drills, with a record number of other countries participating or observing. Super Garuda Shield is one of the biggest multilateral exercises in the Indo-Pacific. It aims to boost security cooperation to keep the region free and open. Indonesia and the U.S. have staged the drills annually since 2007. They were expanded in 2022 to involve troops from other countries. This year, more than 20 nations have sent forces. This year's drills, held through September 6th, will focus on cybersecurity and training to retake captured islands. Southeast Asian countries, including Indonesia, lie in the center of the Indo-Pacific, where key sea lanes are located.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he'll present a plan next month to U.S. President Joe Biden to end the war in Ukraine. Zelensky stressed the main objective is to force Russia to end its invasion and obtain fair terms for Ukraine. Zelensky made the announcement at a news conference in the capital Kyiv on Tuesday. He told reporters Ukraine's cross-border offensive in the western Russian region of Kursk is one stage of the plan. Meanwhile, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has called for peace talks. He spoke to Russian President Vladimir Putin on the phone on Tuesday. Modi's call follows his visit last Friday to Ukraine. It was his first trip to the country since the start of Russia's invasion. He urged Zelensky to start peace talks. The Kremlin has repeatedly ruled out negotiating peace with Kyiv following Ukraine's cross-border offensive on Kursk.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his pilots are now flying F-16 fighter jets to repel Russian attacks. He says they've had good results with the Western-made warplanes, and he wants more to guard his skies. Ukrainians have waited for months for the new fighters. In just the past few days, their cities came under bombardment from Russian missiles and drones. Strikes have knocked out water and electricity. Kyiv is facing an emergency blackout. The first batch of F-16s arrived about a month ago to give Ukrainian pilots an edge against Russian air power. Zelensky is pressing his allies for more of the fighters.
It's not enough. We're a small number of F-16, and we need to do wider training mission and etc.
Russian authorities have also seen threats from above. The governor of the southern region of Rostov says drones from across the border sparked a fire at a fuel depot. And as the Ukrainian operation in Russia's Kursk region continues, a U.S. think tank says Russian forces have made a relatively rapid advance in eastern Ukraine. Analysts say the troops have pushed along a railway line, avoiding urban combat. They say the soldiers' progress has been enabled by the withdrawal of Ukrainian units.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they are heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com. or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many thanks to everyone who has ever helped to keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please help me keep this program going. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. California Congressperson Barbara Lee is speaking out against the U.S. blockades of Cuba. The electrical grid was again attacked in Venezuela, which the government blames on far-right terrorists. Amnesty International in London called for a war crimes investigation into a new Israeli bombing of another refugee camp. Human Rights Watch reports that Palestinian healthcare workers are being rounded up from medical facilities, sent to detention centers in Israel, and then severely mistreated and some tortured. Radio Havana, Cuba.
U.S. Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Lee has described Washington's blockade against Cuba as obsolete and harmful, and said that she will work to achieve a more intelligent and humane policy towards the Caribbean island nation. A member of the House of Representatives for California since 1998, Barbara Lee has recalled that she has deployed her efforts in Washington to change Washington's policy toward Cuba for four decades, and she is committed to lifting the failed embargo or the blockade on Cuba. Barbara Lee said the United States should support the efforts of the Cuban people to build a peaceful and prosperous society which can satisfy the hopes and needs of the Cuban people. And she added, "We can see the Cuban people organizing to achieve this." Barbara Lee, who was the president, former president of the Congressional Black Caucus. The U.S. policy, she said, towards Cuba continues to be based on the idea that punishing Cubans is somehow helping them. She recalled that during the Barack Obama administration, some important measures were adopted to rethink Washington's strategy towards Cuba.
Venezuela's Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello has denounced the commission of a new terrorist attack perpetrated by the far right against the national electrical system. He said, quote, "The far right resorts to these methods because they know that peace is prevailing, because they are defeated, and because their violent agenda is failing. Our response will be forceful." Cabello added that the people voted for the re-election of President Nicolas Maduro. An attack on a transmission tower has left the capital city of Caracas and the states of Táchira, Mérida, Barinas, Zulia, Anzoátegui, Falcón, and Nueva Esparta without power. There was also a partial suspension of services in La Guaira and Miranda. Caballo said that this institution is working together with the Ministry of Electric Power to resolve the issue and to identify those responsible for the terrorist attack. Quote, "We knew they were planning this type of attack, not only against the electrical service, but also against other public services that are widely used by the people." Amnesty International in London is calling for a war crimes investigation into an Israeli attack that killed at least 36 Palestinians sheltering in tents in West Rafah on May the 26th, including a toddler and a woman who were decapitated by metal fragments. Amnesty weapons experts who analysed photographs taken of the attack found Israeli forces dropped US-made 113-kilogram, that's 249-pound bombs, capable of throwing metal fragments for hundreds of metres. Amnesty International said it identified four fighters killed in the attack, but questioned Israel's claim to it used, quote, "the smallest munitions that could be launched from fighter jets," and said it appears the attack was, quote, "both disproportionate and indiscriminate." The Israeli military would have been fully aware that the use of bombs that project a deadly shrapnel across hundreds of meters would kill and injure a large number of civilians. This, according to Erica Guevara Rosas, Amnesty International Senior Director for Research and Advocacy. She said, "Under international humanitarian law, the presence of fighters in the targeted area does not absolve the Israeli military of its obligation to protect civilians. Many observers noted that the Israeli regime has now carried out hundreds of massacres of tens of thousands and should be held accountable for these wanton crimes against humanity. Palestinian healthcare workers have been rounded up from medical facilities in Gaza, sent to detention centers in Israel, and then severely mistreated and some tortured. In an HRW report released on Monday, they detailed the alleged torture, threats of rape and sexual abuse by Israeli forces, denial of medical care, and poor detention conditions. Balkis Jarrah, acting Middle East director of HRW, said in a statement, "The Israeli government's mistreatment of Palestinian healthcare workers continues in the shadows and needs to stop immediately. The torture and other ill treatment of doctors, nurses, and paramedics must be thoroughly investigated and appropriately punished, including by the International Criminal Court, the ICC. HRW's interviews with 8 released healthcare workers and 7 witnesses has confirmed mistreatment, humiliation, blindfolding, beatings, forced stress positions, and prolonged cuffing in Israeli custody. One paramedic, Walid Khalili, told HRW that he was blindfolded, taken to Israel's Taiman Military Detention Center, known for the rape of at least one Palestinian detainees, and once his blindfold was removed, he saw, in a large warehouse-like building, dozens of detainees hanging by chains attached to handcuffs. Walid Khalili was likewise chained and hung. HRW reported that the detained healthcare workers have been held without charge for up to 7 days or 5 months. They were pressured to confess to being members of Hamas through various threats of indefinite detention, rape, and the killing of their families in Gaza. None was ever informed for the reason for the detention or charged with any offense.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcasts. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website, along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from spinal injury and staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.